Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. If this is one of your first times here, I recommend highly that you come back. Of course I recommend that. But our services are very different sometimes, so they will be led either by myself, Prairie's consulting minister, Sandy is my name, or they'll be led by someone from within our congregation, or occasionally we have outside speakers, as we did just last week, I believe. We welcome all, no matter where you are on this spiritual journey or this journey of life, no matter what your religious, sacred, spiritual beliefs, no matter your ethnicity, your gender preference, your sexual preference, you are welcome here. We try to be open and welcoming to all. The opening words are these. We gather this day. We come in search of life's meaning. All of us have moments of weakness and times of strength. All sing songs of sorrow and love. May our time here bring us strength along our way. In the presence of the sacred, may we come to know our true selves, finding a fresh impulse to love and do good. Mary, if you would like the chalice, please. Thank you. For centuries, people have told stories, celebrated life, and approached the ultimate while gathered around a fire. Today, we light this chalice, that the hearth fire of our hearts may be rekindled, that our stories may be retold, that we might celebrate life anew, and that we might approach what is of ultimate value. And now, invite the young people, young at heart, or young chronologically, to come up for this morning's story, which is about a little boy, Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge, who cares a lot about his elderly friends and helps one of them, Miss Nancy Allison Delacourt Cooper, remember many of the All Souls who have been part of her life. Good morning. There was a small boy called Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge, and what's more, he wasn't very old either. By the way, this was written by a woman who lives in Australia, so there might be a few words that we don't necessarily use, but I'll try to explain if there are. His house was next door to an old people's home, and he knew all the people there. He liked Mrs. Jordan, who played the organ. He listened to Mr. Hosking, who told him scary stories. He played with Mr. Tippett, who was crazy about cricket. Cricket is a game that they play in other countries. Some people say it's like baseball, but it really isn't exactly. He ran errands for Miss Mitchell, who walked with a wooden stick. And he admired Mr. Drysdale, who had a voice like a giant. But, yes. His favorite person of all was Miss Nancy Allison Delacourt Cooper, because she had four names, just as he did. He called her Miss Nancy, and he told her all his secrets. One day, Wilfred Gordon heard his mother and father talking about Miss Nancy. "Poor old thing," said his mother. "Why is she a poor old thing?" asked Wilfred Gordon. "Because she's lost her memory," said his father. "It isn't surprising," said his mother. "After all, she is 96. "What is a memory?" asked Wilfred Gordon. He was always asking questions. "It's something you remember," said his father. But Wilfred Gordon wanted to know more, so he called on Mrs. Jordan first, and he said, "What's a memory?" "Something warm, my child, something warm." And then he called on Mr. Hoskins, who told him scary stories. "What's a memory?" Wilfred Gordon asked. "Something from long ago, me lad, long ago." Well, then he went to see Mr. Tippett,
who was crazy about cricket, "What's a memory?" he asked. "Something that makes you cry, boy. Something that makes you cry." Well, then he went to see Miss Mitchell, who walked with a wooden stick. "What's a memory?" he said. "Oh, something that makes you laugh, lad. Something that makes you laugh." Finally, he went to see Mr. Drysdale, who had a voice like a giant. "What's a memory?" Wilfred Gordon asked.
"Something as precious as gold, young man. As precious as gold."
So Wilfred Gordon went home and stuck his head in the chicken coop and looked at the hen, and then he thought, I guess I'll have to go find some memories for Miss Nancy. First, Wilfred Gordon looked in his shoebox, where he had shells that he'd found a long time ago. Well, last summer, a long time ago for him, and he put them gently in a basket. He found the puppet on strings, which always made everyone laugh. And he put the puppet in the basket, too. And then he found a medal, and you can just barely see it in there and with the shells and the puppet. It's a medal which his grandfather had given him a long time ago. His grandfather had died, and he put that medal in there gently. And then, finally, Wilfred Gordon went into the hen house and got a warm egg that had just been laid. Then he went to visit Miss Nancy, and he gave her those things, one by one. What a dear boy, but what a strange child to bring me these wonderful things, thought Miss Nancy. But then she began to remember. She held that egg and told Wilfred Gordon about the time she saw the tiny little bird's eggs in a nest in her aunt's garden. And then she looked at those shells, and she remembered that she went to the seashore a long time ago, and when she was a little girl, you wore these shoes that came way up here and buttoned, and when she was at the seashore, they were too warm, so she took them off in the sand. And then she thought about that medal, M-E-D-A-L, that was in the basket of shells, and she remembered her brother who went away to war a long, long time ago and never came back. And then she looked at the puppet, and she smiled because she remembered that she had had a puppet when she was a little girl, and she had a sister who was even smaller and younger than her, and she used the puppet. And the sister giggled, and the sister had a mouthful of porridge, which we would call cereal, and spit it out, and they laughed. And then Miss Nancy picked up that football, which was probably really a soccer ball, and she bounced it with Wilfred Gordon. And they thought about all the secrets that they had told each other. And the two of them smiled and smiled because Miss Nancy's memory had been found again by a small boy. It wasn't very old either.
The reading that I would like to share with you this morning is titled "The Medicine is in the Altar," written by Unitarian Universalist minister Kathleen McTigg. She writes, "The ancient Irish believed that around this time of year, as autumn tips toward winter, the veils that separate the living from the dead begin to thin and vanish. And that if we listen carefully enough, we might even hear again from those we've lost. Don't we all sometimes have an intuition of this mysterious idea? I know a man who lost his teenaged son in a car accident. In the terrible days immediately following, he woke at dawn every morning with a powerful sense that his son was sitting calmly on the edge of the bed, tenderly resting his hand on his father's shoulder. My friend doesn't believe in this sort of thing. He doesn't believe the dead visit us in any form. Yet, He says, the physical sense of that warm weight resting on his shoulder was so vivid that he woke those mornings not only with his searing grief, but with a strange sense of peace and indelible connection. Our world is filled with stories like this one. How do we understand them? Are they ghost stories? Imagination? Tricks of the mind? Delusion? Or is it truer, though perhaps less comfortable, to simply admit that there is a whole universe of knowledge that is not ours, at least not yet, and that the kingdom of death is in that universe? What do we really know about death, except that we'll each take our turn walking through its shadowed gate? I sat by my father's bed, writes McTeague, as he moved through the last days and nights of his life. It was intense and painful. It was also wondrous and awesome to hold his hand as the light left his eyes. In the weeks that followed, I struggled with my grief, and then my father showed up in a dream, so powerful. It felt like a visitation. In the dream, he was thin and sick, standing by a bureau with his back to me. As I entered the room, my greeting startled him so that a huge collection of pills he had been arranging scattered from his hands and fell. "Pick them up," he demanded. As I bent to do it, I saw that the pills had all fallen onto the little altar, which in waking life sits in my home as the focus of my meditation practice. There the pills had mingled with the small shiny stones I've collected from faraway beaches, and as I looked, I saw it would be impossible to separate them out from each other. That's all there was. I awoke from the dream and immediately said to myself, the medicine is in the altar. Though I often disagreed with my father while he lived and just as often ignored his advice, this dream father gave me a reminder I needed to hear. In the quiet of meditation, I found the comfort that sustained me through the worst of my grieving. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children, asks Walt Whitman in Leaves of Grass. Surely, we carry them with us. Their wisdom and love are rooted in our own minds and hearts, rising to the surface unexpectedly from time to time, mingled inseparably with our own thoughts and visions. The great cloud of witnesses who have lived and died before us breathe out to us in all the forms of life our sweet world device. They are all around us. The ancient Celts had it right. The separation between the living and the dead is thin as a veil, but not just in the darkening of the year. It's always there. If we quiet ourselves enough, we can still hear their voices there in our own hearts beating. My favorite Unitarian Universalist holiday is All Souls Day. Yes, I know, it isn't really a holiday unique to Unitarian Universalism. For that matter, it isn't exactly a real holiday, because no one gets November 2nd off. Kids go to school, banks and libraries stay open. Nevertheless, as I said in this month's newsletter, one of the first services I attended at First Unitarian Society here in Madison, my home Unitarian Universalist Church, was a celebration of All Souls Day. So perhaps I can be forgiven for thinking of it as a UU holiday. In that newsletter column, I write that when I look back at that November Sunday in the mid-1970s, I realize that it was a turning point in my life. I was new to Unitarian Universalism. I had never heard someone articulate our connection to all the souls who ever lived the way that Reverend Max Gabler did that morning. I had felt this connection deep in my bones for as long as I could remember, but was unable to put it into words. I come from a long line of dead people, songwriter Libby Roderick says in her song Bones, don't we all? There are many, many of those dead people standing up here behind me in that cloud of witnesses that accompanies us everywhere we go. It's crowded up here. 1 year ago yesterday, November 2nd, 2012, on All Souls Day, I was in Mesa Verde National Park in the southwest corner of Colorado. This was, I think, my fourth or fifth trip there. The first time was when I was 11 or 12 years old, and even at that age, I had a whoa experience. It is hard for me to describe what happened on that trip, being there among those cliff dwellings, being in those ruins and listening to what must have been an amazing ranger, were important factors in my being a history major as an undergraduate years later. On that trip a year ago, I had Mesa Verde almost completely to myself. I discovered some ruins that I hadn't known about previously, and as I walked around and through them, those where you are allowed to do that, I remembered that All Souls Day from the mid-70s. Once again, I was at a loss for words. The same thing happened to me 5 years ago on that first trip into Grand Canyon down to the bottom, first trip for me down to the bottom. I don't know why, but I was surprised to find ancient Puebloan ruins there beside the Colorado River. Now, that site is very small. It's not much bigger than the space up here. But between my imagination and some very descriptive, I don't know what they're technically called, signboards, you know, in national parks where they tell you lots of facts that you can't remember 10 minutes later. But between those things, I could picture the homes of these ancient peoples. I could imagine them there, the children playing and the women making pottery and all sorts of containers and the men preparing to go find something to eat. Maybe the women were too. What I have experienced in all these settings is about feeling. It's all about feeling. Feeling, not trying to rationalize it up here like we Unitarian Universalists often do, but feeling the presence of the ancient ones around me, knowing intuitively that I am connected to those ancient Puebloan people. It was a mystic experience. I can embrace mystic experiences. That's what this morning should be about, not necessarily a mystic experience, but feeling the presence of all the souls who have made our lives possible. Today, during this celebration of All Souls, I remember those ancient peoples and I honor them. I put them in the empty chair. It is crowded up here. You are invited to imagine any of your own dearly departed dead people, the souls from your own cloud of witnesses. You are invited to imagine them in the chair. Imagine them passing on to you words of wisdom, perhaps the secret of life, if you're lucky, contained within that phrase, everlasting word, which we sang about in the opening hymn. What is the everlasting word? Perhaps it is compassion. But I think there are probably many everlasting words, and we are celebrating them today. They guide us on our way, and so we remember all souls. Or do we? Are we honoring all the souls who came before us? What about the bad souls? Hitler, Pol Pot, Genghis Khan, Mussolini, Stalin, and on and on. Well, I don't really have an answer. But perhaps one answer to that dilemma can be found in that reading from Kathleen McTeague after she asked Whitman's questions from Leaves of Grass. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? McTeague answers, surely we carry them with us. Their wisdom and love are rooted in our own minds and hearts. Might there then be souls we don't celebrate because there's nothing there to celebrate? Instead, maybe we need to concentrate on remembering all those throughout human history who have been the targets of these oppressors, dictators, cruel people. All those people, abused, downtrodden, who were never able to reach their full human potential. We owe them our remembrances. We honor them by the way we live. We put them today in the empty chair. I was walking through the University of Wisconsin campus here in Madison one day last week, and as I went past the engineering buildings, I had a near mystical experience. I spent a lot of time in those buildings working in nuclear and mechanical engineering. We had friends from all over the world. Many of these friends were getting graduate degrees in engineering, as was my then husband. Plus, we lived in Eagle Heights, where all our neighbors and closest friends were from some other country. Walking past these familiar buildings, I saw ghosts. Well, it was only a day before Halloween, after all. For me, remembering all souls sometimes includes the living, as well as those not living. At least one of those long ago friends has died, victim of that cruelty I mentioned. Alex, dear, dear friend, office mate to husband Mike, a regular at our house for dinners and laughter. Alex died because of the policies of the, can never say his name correctly, Ceausescu administration in Romania in the 90s, which would not, or late 80s, I guess, which would not allow him, Alex, to go to the Soviet Union for the cancer treatment he needed, which was unavailable in Romania at that time. They wouldn't allow him to go because he had been to the United States too many times and was suspect, though of what I was never sure. I remember Alex, and I put him in the chair, and it continues to be crowded up here. I don't know whether or not any others from that circle of friends and acquaintances have died. I don't think so. But I do know that they all played a part in my becoming a Unitarian Universalist, because I learned from them firsthand, in the real world, that we are all connected. All interdependent, no matter our country of origin. In my immediate family, I remember first my granddad, my mother's father, my favorite relative, all 4'11" of him. I don't know if he ever even heard of Unitarian Universalism, even though our town was only 18 miles from Meadville, and some of you may have heard of Meadville Lombard, Meadville, Pennsylvania. So as I reflected on All Souls Day, I wondered why this particular granddad came into my head as someone who played an important part in my becoming a Unitarian Universalist. Perhaps because of the unconditional love that I received from him. You're very fortunate in life if you have at least one person who gives you unconditional love. Hope often stems from that kind of love. Optimism, too. Granddad can take a turn in the chair now. It's crowded up here. But what about those departed people with whom we still have issues? How should they be remembered? I have a difficult time not being angry with my dad, who died almost 6 years ago. I know that it is time to let go of the issues, but that's not always so easy. He did, though, much to my surprise, fully support my decision to go back to school to study for the ministry. I remember that I did not want to tell him that I had been accepted at a seminary and hoped to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. I was sure that he would belittle that decision, be condescending. He was a bully. My mother, of course, just looked at me somewhat incredulously and said, "Well, of course you have to tell him." She said something like, "How am I going to explain your disappearance for 3 or 4 years?" So I gulped and told him about my plans, and he got it. He was supportive. He bragged about me to his Presbyterian buddies. A little black humor here. This might have been a good time for one of us to die, so that we could have ended our relationship on an upbeat note. And there, at Star King School for the Ministry, I met the most amazing people. I mean, in addition to my classmates and professors and the staff at the school, I'm talking about the dead people I was introduced to in classes. For example, sociologist and educator Robert Bella, who was very much alive when I read his works in a class called Moral Commonwealth. Some of you may have heard of Bella. He's quite well known. He wrote Habits of the Heart. He wrote The Good Society. He was always interested in how to improve institutions so they might work better, work at all in some cases. And he was interested in the religious aspect of that. How do you make institutions sacred and keep them secular? I'm greatly paraphrasing here. Bella died this year, July 30th, 2013. He was one of my honeys. Now, I can't remember if I've mentioned this concept to you before. One of my professors, Claire Fisher, introduced me to honeys, or to the concept of honeys. People whom we greatly admire and wish we could meet them, have coffee or tea or whatever with them, and what would surely be an amazing conversation as we got to know them, and sometimes we can. Claire Fisher, my professor, did meet Robert Bella, and they became good friends. He even came to our class one day. But by the time we meet our honeys, they've already died, so we can only imagine what it would have been like to know them. All those amazing free thinkers, it has been a great privilege to have met so many of them. I've introduced you to some of them, as many people who've been up here leading Sunday services have done that. Robin Proud comes to mind, and I know she's downstairs so she can't hear this, but just 2 weeks ago she introduced us to Lydia Maria Child, a woman from the mid-1800s who was, to say she was way ahead of her time, understates it. Her story breaks my heart. Oh, there's Lydia Maria Child now on the chair, crowded up here. I haven't said much yet about the humanists from up here or the humanist controversy in our history, but eventually I will. And if we claim to be a predominantly humanist congregation, then we need to know whereof we speak. Many of you will recognize these three names: John Dietrich, Charles Potter, Curtis Rees. Well, now, why might you recognize those names? Anybody? Uh-oh. We have some work to do. Well, they did not write the Humanist Manifesto of 1933, one of the most important documents in our history, but they were perhaps the most important signers of that document, which that was way ahead of its time too. Humanism was a logical next step for Unitarians and Universalists after the Transcendentalist controversy had subsided, and Transcendentalism had become not only accepted, but an integral part of our faith tradition. Although the humanist controversy is not over and has been the subject of some interesting revisionism recently, the humanists belong up here too, regardless of what their legacy ends up being. I especially want to put Curtis Rees in the chair. When I was the minister of the Burlington, Iowa Unitarian Universalist Fellowship from 2002 to 2005, that congregation celebrated two milestones: the 52nd anniversary of their founding, and then the 50th anniversary of purchasing their building, which they were still in. It was an honor to be the minister speaking at both of these occasions. I knew that Curtis Rees had done some part-time consulting ministry in his retirement years for the Burlington Fellowship. So I looked in some old files, and there it was, the sermon, the original sermon on crackling, coming apart paper the sermon that he gave on the anniversary of their founding from the very pulpit where I stood on Sunday mornings. And that's not all. Who do you think gave the sermon to celebrate the founding of the congregation 52 years earlier? Max Gabriel. Curtis Reese, I remember him and give him a turn sitting in that chair. And now one more soul to remember, and then it will be your turn. Unitarian Universalist minister James Luther Adams. How many of you have heard of him? We got work to do. James Luther Adams was one of the most noted and respected theologians of the 20th century. Not just for Unitarian Universalists. I'm talking about theologians all over the world. We can be very proud of him. He was a disciple of that Unitarian Humanist minister, John Dietrich, I just mentioned. But Adams eventually went beyond the humanists, mainly because of their, this is James Luther Adams' phrase. The only problem I have with Adams is that he uses these words that I have to keep looking up. Adams was opposed to humanism eventually, not all of humanism, but parts of it, largely because of its, and I'm not even sure I can say this first word, atomistic, A-T-O-M-I-S-T-I-C, individualism. What, Ian? Atomistic? Atomistic. I don't know if that means anything to you, but I think for our purposes at the moment, we can equate it to that rugged individualism of which I keep warning you. Adams was wary of both ends of the spectrum of what it means to be human, that rugged individualism at the one end, and at the other end, anything that would obliterate the individual, think fascism and communism. James Luther Adams believed strongly that there had to be a third possibility for becoming fully human, something between the individual and the community. All of his life, he asked the question, what is the ideal relation between the two? Adams thought that one of the most important things we can do as individuals is to belong to voluntary associations, which he defined as the vehicle by which ideas can take historical form and individual freedom can also be preserved. Well, can you guess what Adams thought was one of the most important of all voluntary organizations? Yes, the church, or whatever you're comfortable calling this place, where people from our faith tradition gather. Adams believed that the humanists did not go far enough in defining liberal religion, that their optimism had little substance. Well, remember, the humanists were pretty challenged there when World War I came along, and then there was World War II, and what does that do to your theory of onward and upward forever? Adams did not think that optimism was wrong. He just believed that it needed to be based in reality. And he gave us something called the five smooth stones of liberalism, which we'll explore on another Sunday morning. James Luther Adams had Madison connections. His daughter and son-in-law lived here and were active members at First Unitarian Society and friends of mine. James Luther Adams, who defined God as that which ultimately concerns humanity, or that in which we should place our confidence. That's why we can't use the word God lightly. We have to define it. Adams believed that the whole point of liberal theology is social justice. He wrote, nothing makes a theological liberal, or I would put myself, nothing makes a theological liberal more angry than the suggestion that religion is a matter of the privacy of the heart only, that genuine religion has no direct bearing on questions of justice, equality, and freedom in society. Right. That I agree completely. Nothing makes a theological liberal angrier. Think of the murder of Jesus. Adams is right. Of course, we have a long way to go on the road to social justice, and that is why we take time today to remember all these souls who have understood that the end result of faith or religious organizations is, or should be, justice and mercy. Does history have a meaning, asks Adams in his essay titled Guiding Principles for a Free Faith? Yes, he answers. History is a struggle in dead earnest between justice and injustice, looking towards the ultimate victory in the promise and the fulfillment of grace. And I'm sure we can do more than one Sunday morning service on grace and what that means. Anyone who does not enter into that struggle, says Adams, with the affirmation of love and beauty, misses the mark and thwarts creation as well as self-creation. So there's James Luther Adams in the chair. I remember him, I honor him, he is one of my honeys. I am in awe of these souls who made it possible for me to be standing right here at this All Souls time of the year. It's crowded up here. Humbly we stand in the face of death. Confidently we stand with life. Our strength is the strength of many. Indeed, it is the strength of all humanity throughout all time, because we have one fate and a great compassion. May understanding go with us and peace too, that we may live together in charity, compassion, peace, and joy. In this spirit, let us individually and together go forth to live and to love and to greet your neighbors.